the Bible at different points have been my professional career. And so it's something I've spent a bit of time thinking about, and so it's great to have the opportunity to come and talk to you about it. And money is an issue for all of us. This is one of those rare topics. Sometimes when you go to churches to do topic evenings, you have to spend the first part of the evening convincing people that they really are interested in the topic that you're talking about. But I hope I don't need to convince anybody this evening that you ought to be interested in what we're thinking about. I hope I don't need to convince anybody that this is relevant to you. If you're somebody here tonight that doesn't need to deal in money, then I would love to speak to you afterwards. Because I suspect the only people that is true of are people who have so much money that they have somebody else to look after it for them. But for the rest of us, we all need to think about how we manage our money. It's also worth saying as we begin that in reality, I don't know a lot of you in the room personally, but I'd be pretty confident in saying that we are all rich people in the room this evening. So often our definition of rich people are people that have a little bit more money than I do. But in global terms, everybody in this room is likely to be extremely wealthy. If you had an income last year of over £1,000, regardless of the source of that income, whether you earned it as a salary or whether it was given to you as a kind of student grant or whether your parents supported you, if you had more money, if you had more than £1,000 going into your bank account last year, then you are in the top 20% of earners in the world. If you have any savings at all, then you are more than likely in the top 15% of the wealthiest people on the planet. So this is relevant. It really matters. We are people who need to think very seriously about what we do with our money, how we think about it, how we manage it. This is relevant for us, and I hope this is something we're keen to get right, because we're people who are keen to honour God in every aspect of our lives, and also because the area of money is a key area of Christian distinctiveness. In places like Ephesians 5, the Bible talks about Christians in the world as being as different as light and darkness. Glaringly distinct is the kind of impression that Paul gives us there. But it can be a struggle for us, I think, in some areas, to see how we can be that. How can I, in one sense, just naturally in the way I live my life, stand out as a Christian? What makes me different? What makes me light amongst the people I'm around every day? Well, I think our approach to money should be one such area. It should really be a kind of key and powerful, inoffensive opportunity to demonstrate something of the difference that being a Christian makes, that demonstrates something of the difference that the gospel makes and believing the gospel makes in a really positive sense to those around us. So what I want us to do this evening is consider what I think are three major biblical principles when it comes to money, which are three of the main ways in which the Bible's approach to thinking about and handling money is so different from the world's. And if we've seen this and we're convinced of it and we put it into practice, ways therefore in which our lives might look very different financially from those around us. And therefore ways in which we can commend the gospel and we can do it day by day, pound by pound, penny by penny. I hope all you need is on the handout there. You've got in front of you, that gives you a bit of an outline and some of the passages that we're going to look at. It's worth saying, of course, just by one way of one final caveat before we get into it, we are not going to get anywhere close to saying all that the Bible has to say about money this evening. There's going to be important biblical passages on money that we're not going to really touch on because it's a huge topic and we've only got 50 minutes or so to think about it. But I think as headline principles, these things we're going to think about are a pretty decent summary of what the Bible has to say to us about money. You'll also notice that we are going to be pretty New Testament heavy in terms of what we're going to look at this evening. In one sense, that is purely for simplicity's sake. It's purely so that it's easy for us to see the relevance and the application. That isn't because what the Old Testament has to say about money and what the New Testament has to say about money are glaringly different biblically. I don't think that's the case. We're going to touch on one particular question surrounding that a little bit later. But that's why most of the references are from the New Testament rather than the Old. And you'll notice we're deliberately not going to look at in any detail at anything from 2 Corinthians. Because you guys know more about that than I do, probably. I don't want to interfere with your studies in 2 Corinthians in a way that would be unhelpful. So we're going to look at a whole range of things, but we're going to particularly not look at 2 Corinthians, so that as you continue your studies in 2 Corinthians, think about some more of the money stuff that you're going to see there in chapters 8 and 9. Hopefully, you can kind of bring to bear on that some of the stuff that we're going to think about this evening. Good. Let's get going. So the first thing to say, the first point you can see on your handout there, is that money is God's and not ours. That is the first thing we need to understand about our money. That is, in one sense, one of the most fundamental things we need to understand about our money. Money is God's, not ours. Psalm 24, verse 1 says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it." Let me say that again. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And that is a very straightforward verse of scripture, but it has some very radical consequences. And so here is just one. Your money, every last dime, is God's and not yours. You own nothing. It doesn't belong to you. You've got it all on lend. Well, so let's look for a moment just at somebody who didn't understand that in the Bible. If you turn to Luke chapter 12. If you're using the kind of black Bibles in the pews, we're on page 871. This is the parable of the rich fool. And as I read it, just notice the mistake that the rich fool has made in the way that he thinks about his money. So Luke chapter 12 and from verse 13. But Jesus said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of one's possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." Did you hear the mistake that the rich fool made? I, mine. That is how he sees his money. But the problem is it's not his. It's not mine. It's all God's. And God can take it back. That is true of all of us. And it's true of all our money, all our possessions. They are his and not ours. Much though we might like to think that we've earned those things. That is one of the great lies, I think. I've worked hard, so I'm entitled to my things. Who was it that gave us the skills to do the jobs we do? Who was it that planned for you to be born in the family that gave you the help, gave you the education, maybe gave you the inheritance? Who was it who by his grace determined that you would be born where you were born, live where you live, have the opportunity to end up in a city like London, in a country like Britain, and not spend every day of your life in poverty in another part of the world. It was not you or I that did that. God did all that. It is all owed to him. It is all his. We see that really clearly again just a few chapters onwards, if you flick forward to Luke chapter 19. It's called here the parable of the 10 minas. I think you could call it something like the parable of the assets. Let me read for us from verse 11. As they heard these things, Jesus proceeded to tell a parable, because he was near to Jerusalem, and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. He said, therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas. He gave them an amount of money. He gave them a share of his assets. And he said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your mina has earned 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant. Because you have been faithful in very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit, and reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit, and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank, and at my coming I might have collected it with interest? And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas. And they said to him, Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. See what's going on there in the parable? Jesus tells the story of the rich man who leaves a portion of his assets, leaves some money to these different people to do business with, to invest, to work. And two of them do that pretty well, get 10, get 5. And the other one doesn't do anything with it at all, hides it away in a handkerchief. And when the man comes back, when the ruler comes back, gives him this spiel about, I knew that you were basically a terrible bloke. I knew that you were a kind of totalitarian despot. It's not true. What the man says about the ruler isn't true. It's not an accurate description. And the man says, well, even if you did think that that's what I was like, surely then you would have known that the sensible thing to do would have been at least to have put it in the bank so you've earned a little bit of interest. But you see the point that Jesus is making in the illustration. Jesus here at this point is about to depart. He is on his way to Jerusalem to be crucified, to be resurrected, and to ascend. He's on his way to depart. And they think the kingdom's going to come immediately. But Jesus knows that's not the case. Jesus knows there's going to be a delay before his eventual return. And what is he going to do in the meantime? Well, he is going to leave his servants with assets. He's going to leave his servants, in the illustration in the parable, with money, with which they are to set about his business, because it is his money. And you can apply that more broadly, but it also does apply to our money. We have been given all our money on trust by God, by Jesus, in his absence. And so every decision that we make is not a decision about what I want with my money, but about what God would want, because it is all his. And so we answer to him in terms of what we do with it, just as the kind of the story in the parable makes clear. If you're a worker, or maybe if you're kind of married to somebody who's particularly keen on good financial order, or maybe if you've got parents who take a keen interest in these kind of things, then you'll be used to the idea of having to monitor your spending, produce records, I don't know, receipts or spreadsheets or a budget or all that sort of thing, so that you can demonstrate how you've used the money, how you've used your company's money, or how you've used the organization you work for, how you've used their money, how you've used your family's money, or something like that. Well, as Christians, we are looking after God's money, and we will give an account for it as part of all the things that God has given to us. Just imagine that day when the boss calls you in and says, okay, I want you to talk me through your budget and your expenses. I used to be a charity director, and I had to do that twice a year before, in front of the board, in front of a trustees meeting. A thorough audit. What have you done with the money that you've been given this year? It was no fun. It was a slightly kind of spine-chilling sort of afternoon. One day, God will ask, what did you do with the money I gave you? Randy Alcorn, who's written on these things, I'll mention his book later, he describes our handling of money as a litmus test of our true character. So let me ask us, how much care do we take? Do we even know where our money goes? I don't know how many of you keep any kind of budget or keep any kind of records, have a spending diary, or even something as simple as reading your bank statements, knowing how much is going in and how much is coming out. This sort of thing really matters. If you've got kids, is this the sort of thing that you think about? How are we going to teach them to manage their money, to know the value of their money, to think carefully about what they do with it? Maybe we're the sort of people that are quite good at thinking about our money and planning, maybe making a budget or something like that. Well, if we do that, do we stick to it? Or are we not very disciplined so that actually we don't use our money, we don't use God's money in a way which really reflects our priorities, what we think we ought to be doing with it? If you're somebody who doesn't kind of naturally find managing money in that way easy, you don't find kind of being disciplined with how you spend your money very easy, then let me give you a potential way to think about living for a little while, and that is living in cash. Now, I know in some ways in the modern world that's getting slightly harder to do, but that's because companies are very interested in making it easier for us to spend our money, making it easier for us to be ill-disciplined actually with our money, because now you just don't need to think about it, do you? You just take out the wallet and smack it on the reader or smack it on the kind of cardless thing, and bip, bip, your money's gone. So if you think, well, I'm finding it difficult to kind of stick to the budget I've made, to stick to the plans that I've made, but I know when I go and do my food shop this week, I don't want to spend any more than £20. Why not just take £20 in cash and leave the card at home so that you only spend the amount that you've planned to spend? Because this is all part of our responsibility as stewards of God's money. Making budgets, keeping budgets, even just keeping track of where our money's up to by reading our bank statements, by looking at the balance on the screen at the ATM and all those kind of things. It isn't fun. It isn't exciting. If you're the sort of person that thinks, yes, that is just my dream Saturday night, is just at home going through the receipts, squaring it all up with my spreadsheet, you're a very sad individual. There's no two ways about that. It isn't exciting. But that is not the point. It is part of our responsibility as people who have been given that money on trust, who can't simply think, well, it doesn't matter because it's mine anyway. We are stewards of God's money. We need to think about how we manage it. And one other area where this fact that all our money is God's money should shape our thinking, I think, is the question of tithing. Now, this is a big issue. You might want to ask about it later. I'll have time for questions. But let me give you my tuppence worth on it. I don't believe that we're under the letter of the law in the Old Testament terms. In terms of tithing as a strict 10% approach. So, you know, it's often said that under the Mosaic law and the law that you find in books like Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy, the people required to give 10% of their income in the tithe. And so the question is, well, as Christians now, is that still the case? Ought we still give 10% away, and then we've got 90% effectively to do what we want with? The stuff that's left over is ours. And let me say, I don't think that that approach is necessary. I don't think we are under the letter of the law in that way. And I don't think it's helpful in many cases. It's also, I don't think, exactly what the Old Testament law required. People were almost certainly required to give more than 10% when we look at the law carefully. But the problem is, if we take that 10% figure, then it is far too easy for it to become a sort of dry box-ticking exercise. We give away the 10%, and then I think, great, now I've got 90% of my money to do what I want with. But I don't think that's healthy. I don't think tithing, therefore, necessarily helps foster a good attitude to money if we just do it in a sort of legalistic 10% way. Now, I've given this sort of talk elsewhere, and the thing that people get angriest about, the thing I've had most kind of people coming up to me afterwards and poking me in the chest about is saying you don't have to tithe, you don't have to give a 10%. Because people think, well, that just gives you license not to give, surely, if you say you don't have to give 10%. But in fact, in saying I don't think we are under the law in that way, in saying I don't think we need to just account for 10%, I want to say something much more radical than that. Because I think the New Testament teaches us something much more radical than that. And that is because it tells us that rather than thinking about 10% of our money being owed to God, we need to think about 100% of our money being owed to God. Because it's all His. And so instead of saying, well, I'll start from 10%, I want to say, no, you need to start from 100%. All of your money belongs to God. We will give an answer to God for what we did with all of it, not just 10% of it. That needs to begin to shape our thinking, rather than thinking, well, I can just portion off a little bit, and that keeps God happy. I don't think that is what the Bible teaches us. As I say, do feel free to ask about that later, if that would be helpful. So the first thing we need to recognize about our money is that it is God's and not ours. The second thing we need to recognize is that money is temporary. It has no lasting value. If you turn to Matthew chapter 6, it's on page 811. This is a little bit of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew chapter 6 and from verse 19 says this: Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body, so if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. The first point that Jesus makes in those verses is pretty hard to argue with. It's a point about the transitory nature of the material world, both our money and everything that our money can buy us. That point there in verses 19 and 20, I presume I don't have to labour really. We all know through repeated bitter experience that stuff doesn't last. Many of us might find that today. I don't think any of us would be absolutely flabbergasted if on the way home we sat down on the tube and our trousers ripped. Or we then kind of got off the tube and our mobile phone is so slippery in our icy hands that we drop it on the floor and it smashes to bits. And then we get home and we discover that the lock's been busted and the TV, the laptop, and all our jewellery's gone. It would be unlucky. I mean, it would be quite flabbergasting if that all happened to you tonight. That would be a particularly poor sequence of events. But still, if any one of those things happened, you wouldn't think, I can't believe it. This is absolutely unbelievable. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Things don't last. Things break, they get nicked, they wear out. But it's important to see here that in verse 22 and 23, Jesus wants to show us that living for money now, even though it doesn't last, isn't just an issue for those of us that have it. Because our eyes can govern the balance sheets of our hearts just as much as our cash does. In one sense, you can never have money and yet be totally blinded by money, be totally misled by money your entire life. Because you think it can do something for you that it can't. So the shop window, the property section in the paper, that travel website, can be just as big a stumbling block as any kind of investment portfolio in real life. The items that we browse, the items that we look at with our eyes, that lead our hearts astray, can be just as easy to trip over as the ones that we buy. And so it's worth us asking ourselves, how much of my security is in my stuff? Either the stuff that I do have, or the stuff that I just wish I had. The stuff that makes me think it would all be okay if I had X amount in the bank account, if I had this much in my pension, or if I just owned that property, or whatever it happens to be. How much of how confident I am about the future is based on how I feel like I'm doing financially? Here's what you might use as a barometer of that. How much does economic news affect your mood? How much do you feel yourself getting kind of edgy, a little bit sort of wound up and nervous when you read about the Brexit slowdown or job losses or house prices falling or stock markets or inflation or whatever it happens to be? How much of your sense of security is tied to how are we doing economically? In the very next section of the Sermon on the Mount, having warned the people listening of the danger of trying to live for money, the danger of trying to serve money instead of God, or of thinking that they could serve money and God, he says this in verses 25 and 26 of Matthew 6. Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. I can't turn the page. There we go. Are you not of more value than they? See, there is security, according to Jesus. Not in anything you can earn, not in anything you can buy, not in any pension pot or stock option, but in God, in knowing God, in knowing God as your heavenly Father. And knowing, therefore, that God can take care of both what you need now and who has guaranteed you a watertight, recession-free, boom and bust-proof future in and through Jesus. Think back to the rich fool again in Luke 12. Our society, like worldly societies throughout history, believes that somehow it's your money. It's the accumulation of material possessions which is going to provide you with some sort of future security. But Jesus wants us to see here that money by its very nature is insecure because your money is temporary. Even if you're fortunate enough to have nothing in this life separate it from you, you cannot take it with you. It just doesn't last. If you don't believe me, just pop around the corner at some point and stick your head in at the British Museum. There you can find the trinkets and treasures of a whole host of extraordinarily rich people, and they haven't taken a bean with them. Their stuff gathers dust in a museum, useless to them. Money is temporary. It has no lasting value. And so the Bible wants to warn us, and warn us quite strongly, of thinking that money can do stuff for us that it can't. And so just for the next few minutes, just because I'm sure you've had enough of my voice by now, just turn in the kind of little groups around you and pick one of those two verses or kind of sections of verses on your handout, either 1 Timothy 6 or the verses in James 5. Just pick one of them, have a read, and just think, how do they make this point? How do they warn us not to rest a weight on money, not to think that money can do something for us that it really can't? And then we'll gather back together in a few minutes. If you pick the James 5 one, you can just read up to verse 6. If you wanted, you could also read up to you could read a little bit longer and read up to verse 9, because there's some relevant stuff in there as well. But just pick one of those, and then we'll come back together again in about 4 minutes. So just think, how does this passage make this point? All the way, don't buy food, don't buy clothes, don't buy houses, don't go on holiday, don't put anything away for the future. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that I think we need to take a long, hard look at both what we do with our money and think about that as revealing of our attitude to money. Asking the question, why do I do that? What does that show? What does how I manage and spend my money show about how I think about money, how reliant I am on my money, and what would God have to say about it? And that includes our savings, I think. Should I have savings? That's a sort of a pretty common question that people ask. Or to put it the other way, how much should I save versus giving? What should the balance be there? Because the Bible affirms both prudence in using the plenty that we have today to cater for the possible scarcity of tomorrow. If you read through the book of Proverbs, you'd find plenty of proverbs about why it's sensible to store up in harvest so that you've got enough food for winter and those kind of ideas. But at the same time, as we've seen, the Bible clearly warns us against putting our confidence in wealth, selfishly hoarding our money. So what do we do? Well, let me just make one quick observation and then suggest a couple of things. And the things I'm going to suggest are just suggestions. They're not hard and fast rules. Hopefully they just provoke us to think a little bit. The observation to make is that I think it is worth noting that our society emphasizes confidence in wealth, particularly through having savings or pensions or investments, or in Britain, in owning a property and having a house or something like that. It emphasizes those things because it has lost sight, at least in part because it has lost sight of the safety nets of family, and it is deprived of the safety net of real community, particularly a community like a church. It's also the case that in an age of individualism, it is seen as a slightly shameful and embarrassing thing or a weak thing to be dependent on others. And so the need to kind of build your own safety net becomes ever more pressing, because either I can't rely on my parents or my family, or I don't want to. There's nobody else around me that's gonna help me out. And it'd be terrible if I had to kind of, rely on the state or something like that to support me. That is often, I think, the way people think. But the Bible won't have that. We ought to recognize our vulnerable need as people, recognize that all of us, in one sense, are only a couple of events away from being in desperate straits. And so we need to both gladly support each other as and when we are able, and be glad recipients of the support of others at times, whether that is through our own families, whether that is through being part of a church family, being happy to ask, even if we find it embarrassing, being happy to receive. The church ought to be, in that sense, a beautifully countercultural safety net for its members. We mustn't, as Christians, let pride make us greedy. That's just an observation. And then two suggestions as we think about savings and those kind of things, bearing in mind the kind of the temporary nature of money. The first suggestion is that we need to think about saving for a rainy day, not saving for a rainy decade. It is wise, I think, to have enough in savings if we're able, so that should we lose our income, should we have an unexpected cost of some sort, that we could survive for a while. Only having enough kind of in our bank account or stuffed under the mattress or something like that, so that we could only get by for a couple of weeks if we weren't able to work, or for some reason money that was being transferred to us didn't reach us or something like that, that would probably not be sensible. That would be a little bit close to the bone. But having enough money stored up the whole time such that we could comfortably survive for, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years if we suffered some sort of kind of drop in income, well, that seems both unnecessary and unrealistic. That seems to be building bigger barns. So save for a rainy day, not for a rainy decade. And then the second suggestion would be to give first, save second. It is just too easy to focus on possible future needs of our own, which may or may not come to pass, whilst at the same time ignoring the present day needs of others, which we could put our money towards, both practical needs and spiritual needs. So having taken care of living expenses, let giving be the priority and save out of the surplus. Living, giving, saving, in that order. Just suggestions, just to help us think about it. I think, by the way, we can say similar things, not just about kind of savings accounts or bits of pots of money that we might be able to access, but about pensions and about money that we store up for retirement, which we have to think about now, even when we're quite young. We need to think about that. The government's really keen in this country that we think about that nice and early. But we need to recognise as Christians that the world's ideal of retirement, we do find in the Bible, I think it is exactly that represented by the rich fool in Luke 12. When we read about the rich fool there, we see that that guy has earned his money and retired early. Actually, he's taken early retirement, he's got lots of resources, pleasure, leisure, eat, drink and be merry. That guy is living the dream. And of course, saving up for a big and long and expensive retirement like that man does makes perfect sense if you've only got one life. The pattern might actually look roughly biblical. Birth, work, rest. But it misses one crucial stage that the Bible inserts for us. Birth, work, death, rest. That is the biblical pattern. Again, I want to be a little bit careful here. It makes perfect sense for us to have pensions so that we aren't an unnecessary burden when we can't work for an income in the way that we do when we're younger and stronger and so on. But I do think that for Christians, the kind of idealized vision of a life of ease in retirement is problematic. And it is always great, I think, when you meet older Christians who are working exceptionally hard, maybe not being paid for it necessarily, but who have not stopped working because they recognize that this life isn't all they've got. And so even into old age, they're giving themselves sacrificially in terms of their time, in terms of their energy. They're not just wanting to kind of kick back and play golf and go on cruises or whatever it is that people are supposed to do when they retire. Because they recognize that the body they've got now is temporary and they might as well wear it out because there is a much, much better one coming. So we may well, I think we ought to have pensions, but the scale of those pensions needs to be carefully considered. We need to ask ourselves the question, am I looking forward to enjoying the niceties of life in my retirement? Or am I just thinking carefully about how I provide for myself in the necessities rather than just storing up excess? Our money should be a very light thing to us, not a dead weight. It should be an easy thing in many ways for us to let it go now because we know that we cannot keep hold of it anyway. Christians shouldn't throw their money around carelessly, as we thought about earlier, but neither should it be impossible to separate a Christian's money from them. Which brings us to our final point. Point three there on the sheet. Money should be invested in eternity, not today. Turn again in Luke to Luke 16. There on page 875. Let me read another parable for you from verse 1. Jesus also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful with the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." People often cite Luke's gospel as being the gospel to the poor. But it's better, I think, to say that Luke's gospel is the gospel to all, because Luke is all about salvation. Salvation unto eternal prosperity for anyone. That is what the good news to the poor is in Luke's gospel. In fact, what we've just been looking at in verse 12, what we thought about earlier with the rich fool, shows us it would make no sense whatsoever for Luke to be writing to encourage material answers to the world's problems. No, it is the gospel of eternal salvation from sin through Jesus that is the big deal in the gospel of Luke. And in Luke, interestingly, Jesus does often talk about money. We've already seen a few examples of it. And this parable, although a slightly odd one at first glance, brings those two things together. The priority of the gospel, the priority of winning people for the kingdom, and money. Jesus instructs us on how to use our money now to work towards salvation in eternity, both for us and for others. We don't have time for to delve in lots of detail, but the big point here is that we are to be like the manager. We're to be like him in his shrewdness, not in his dishonesty. But in his shrewdness, we are to use whatever we can, whatever material possessions we're afforded, to make it possible for others to be there in eternity, to make friendships that will last forever, as we see in verse 9. And sure, our financial priorities need to reflect God's eternal priorities. That is how a Christian is shrewd with their money. They invest in things that last forever by investing in eternity, in seeking salvation for others. That's why giving to gospel ministry has to be a key part, not the only part, I don't think, but certainly the key part of what it means to be biblical with our bank accounts. If the proclamation of the gospel is going to happen so that people hear the offer of eternal life through Jesus, then that will require people to proclaim it, as we see in places like 1 Corinthians 9, verse 14, if you want a proof text for that. It's helpful, of course, in places like this, that there are buildings which are in good order, there are sound systems that work and so on, and all that costs money. People need to be sent to places where the gospel is not proclaimed currently, so that people there might hear it. Increasingly in Britain, it's right on our doorstep. It's parts of the UK where there are no churches teaching the gospel. There's nobody holding out the hope of eternal life to people. It might be with other mission partners in Europe. I know you guys here are involved with people over in France and the Belgian Bible Institute and things like that. People need to be sent to preach the gospel where it's not being preached at the moment. But this doesn't just need to be when you start to talk about kind of giving for eternity. People think, oh, this is the kind of standing order gift aid bit where we get told to give to church. But this isn't just that. I think we can use other resources, we can use other possessions, other material things we have to further the cause of the gospel. You see that happening in the gospels. In Mark 2, for example, Levi, on becoming a disciple, uses his house. He becomes the kind of host who takes people in so that they can have dinners, so Jesus can meet and speak to the kind of the tax collectors and sinners and so on. For us, that might mean we spend money going out for dinner with people from university or work or things like that. Choosing to spend money on things we wouldn't necessarily choose to spend money on if it was just us making the decision. But so that we have the opportunity to get to know people, so that we have the opportunity to welcome people into our homes. We go to the expense, we go to the trouble to do those kind of things so that people have the opportunity to hear and believe the gospel. If I can really push us into uncomfortable territory, let me put it the other way. If we are stewards of God's money and God has told us what is valuable, that God has told us that what is lasting is eternity, and the main task that he has given us with the perishing resources we have is the work of making disciples, how much of what we do with our money has no eternal benefit whatsoever? How much of it is just, I want this, and I want it now? The consistent message of the Bible, the consistent message of the New Testament, is that the Christian life is one of sacrifice now for the reward of heaven. How much are we sacrificing? How much does it cost us, literally, to be a Christian? Because if the lives of Christians living for eternity and non-Christians living for today, if they look the same, then somebody isn't living consistently. And I think the world is giving living for now a pretty good go. Paul says if that's what you're trying to do, if you're trying to live for now, in fact, we heard it as well again in The Rich Fool in Luke 12, what you will do is you will eat, drink, and be merry. Which sounds about right, I think. Seems to me that that is what most people in London are happily getting on trying to do. So the question is, what about us? Would people be able to tell by the way that we live, by the way that we use our money and our resources, that we are living for something so much bigger, so much better than that? In a minute, I'm going to recommend this book to you, but let me just read a quote from it. This is actually a quote originally from C.S. Lewis. I do not believe one can settle how much we ought to give. I am afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. In other words, if our expenditure on comforts, luxuries and amusements and so on is up to the standard common amongst those with the same income as our own, we are almost certainly giving away too little. If our charities do not at all pinch or hamper us, I should say they are too small. There ought to be things we should like to do and cannot do because our giving excludes them. There's a real danger for us in all of this, in flirting with living a life, with managing our money, as if we want to have our cake and eat it, trying to persuade myself that I can love God and I can love money and enjoy the lifestyle it affords. But we've heard it twice in two totally separate places. You cannot serve God and money. Money can block your way to eternity if money becomes the thing that directs and defines you and not your relationship to God. The Bible is full of warnings to the rich. And we are the rich in this room. In global terms, we are the rich. And so we need to be warned that money is a great snare of worldliness and a magnet away from God. We do very well if we teach ourselves and we teach our bank accounts that lesson every once in a while. Just to close, I think Paul in Philippians 3 sums up nicely for us, really, how we ought to view money in the light of eternity. I'll read it out. You don't worry about turning to it. This is Philippians 3 and from verse 8. Paul says, "Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead." I think if you ask the Apostle Paul about his money, he would say it's rubbish. It's rubbish just like everything else compared to Christ. I don't know when the last time was that you looked in your wallet or you checked your bank account and you thought, "Okay, God, what would you have me do with this junk?" Christ has given us salvation. Christ has given us life forever that money cannot buy. But life which money could end up costing us if we're not careful. All life which could be extended to others if we were to use our money in a way which reflected God's priorities for it. If we used the master's assets in the way that he had instructed. It is up to us now to manage our money with that kind of perspective in mind. We may have time for questions, but I'm going to stop speaking there. You'll see on the handout I've put 3 book recommendations. If you do want to think a little bit further about those, they kind of work down in terms of heaviness, both in terms of content and literally, actually, in terms of size. If you want to really seriously think through this, maybe if you work in finance or something like that, or you've just got a particular interest in the area, and you think, "I want to think in real detail about how this plays out in all kinds of areas of money," this book, Money, Possessions and Eternity, by Randy Alcorn, is absolutely fantastic. It is probably, in terms of my kind of practical discipleship, it's definitely in the top 3 best books I've ever read. And so if you want to think really seriously and in some detail about all these things, Money, Possessions and Eternity by Randy Alcorn is absolutely brilliant. If you just want to think in a little bit more detail about how you go about the kind of practice of putting together budgets, thinking about different kind of financial products and how do I get my head around all those, this book called The Money Mentor by a guy called Ash Carter is really good on all that, really practical, really strong. So that would be worth looking at. And if you want a little bit less practice, but you just want a little bit more than we've had tonight in terms of the kind of the theology and the theory and how we ought to think about our money, then Graham Biner's book, Money Counts, is also excellent. So any one of those 3, you would not go far wrong.